girl who used a fake ID to get tattoos in Soho and experimented with Class A drugs. She cut off her dark hair and bleached it. She pierced her lip, her nose, her tongue. Liam hated the tongue piercing. Every time he saw a flash of it, his gut clenched with discomfort. She stopped wearing feminine clothes and started dressing like a 12-year-old boy from the Bronx. Liam didn't mind. When they were alone together, she was just Scarlett, plain and simple, the girl he'd loved since the very first time he'd seen her peeling an egg. They were together for the whole of her 18 months at Maypole House. Liam was easygoing and uncomplicated, a good foil for Scarlett and her moods and her weird friends, and for a while, he had virtually lived at Scarlett's house in the next village along, Dark Place. Words could barely describe the splendour of Scarlett's home. Liam had seen a lot of stunning country homes in his life, but none as beautiful as Scarlett's place. It was in a constant state of improvement during those years. Builders' vans on the driveway, drilling, banging, squares of dusky hues painted onto walls and painted over again, wallpaper samples everywhere, boxes of expensive tiles. Doing the house up was Scarlett's mother's job. Joss was exactly what you'd imagine Scarlett's mum to be like. Loud, bossy, something of a narcissist. Liam met Scarlett's father only once or twice during the 18 months that they were together. Martin Jacques worked in the city and had a pied de terre in Bloomsbury. He was very thin and distant, with a plume of silvery hair and an almost constant twitch in his cheek. And then there was Scarlett's older brother, Rex, closer in age to Liam, awesome guy, right up Liam Street, if a bit full of himself and loud on occasion. Very much his mother's son. The Jacques loved Liam. He was made to feel one of the family, a part of the furniture. Joss always had a little job for him to do, a leaky U-bend that needed tightening, a kettle that needed rewiring, a car that needed to be taken to a garage for a service. And he was always happy to be that guy, the practical guy, the one who could be relied on to know how to reboot a treadmill or keep foxes off your lawn. And then it all changed. Scarlett finished her A-levels in June 2016, after which she and her family went sailing for most of the summer. Liam was invited to go with them, but was needed at home because his dad's back had gone. By the time Scarlett was back from her travels and Liam was back from the Cotswolds, there was barely a moment for them to spend time together before Scarlett started her fine art course at Manton College. Liam, meanwhile, was still at Maypole House, retaking one last A-level. Without their regular lunches together, without the times when they had free periods between lessons and sneaked into Liam's room in the residential block to have sex or watch TV, without the sheer proximity of each other, the whole thing seemed to slide away from them. The easiness and the closeness. And towards the end of that first term, just before Christmas 2016, Scarlett took Liam to the Swan and Ducks and bought him beer and fish and chips and told him that it was probably best if they were just friends. And Liam shrugged and said,
"Yeah, I kind of knew that was coming."
"Are you sad?" she asked, her eyes wide, her bottom lip pinned down on one side by her teeth.
"Yes," he said. "I'm sad."
"I'm sorry," she said, grabbing his hand.
"You don't need to be sorry. You're young. Life moves on."
"I get it. Am I allowed to change my mind?" He laughed.
"Only if you change it in the next 15 minutes. After that, forget it."
She dropped her head onto his shoulder and then looked up at him again and said, "I might just go AWOL without you, you know. I might lose the plot. I might do some terrible things."
"Don't be daft."
"No," she said. "I mean it. You're the thing that keeps me on the straight and narrow. You're the rock. And I'm hacking myself off you. And I don't know what happens after that."
"I'm not going anywhere," he said lightly. "I'm going to be right there."
He pointed through the window of the pub, across the common to Maypole House.
"Yes, but..."
She trailed off, and he saw something dark pass across her face.
"What?"
he said.
"What's the matter?"
"Nothing,"
she said. Nothing's the matter. She forced an unconvincing smile, and then they embraced for a while, and Liam breathed in the smell of her and tried his hardest not to cry, not to show her that she was killing him. Liam went home for Christmas. He was quiet, but nobody noticed, because that wasn't what it was like in his house. He had three brothers and a sister, and now there were nephews and nieces, and there were cows to be carved, fences to be fixed, and bales to be shifted. And by the time Liam got back to Maypole House in January, he was almost over Scarlet. Almost, but not quite. After a few days back at school, he decided to ditch his final retake. He'd only signed up for it so that he could be close to Scarlet, and without Scarlet he was adrift in a school full of people younger than him. He had the grades he needed for his degree at the agricultural college. He didn't need to be there anymore. He planned to leave Maypole House and go home to help his dad with the farm for a few months. But the day he was meant to be leaving, he got a call from Scarlet. I need you, Boobs, she said. She didn't sound like Scarlet. She sounded different. She sounded hollow and scared. What? He said. What's the matter?
I can't tell you on the phone. Can you come here? To the house, please?
Liam looked around his room, at the bags half packed, the empty bookshelves, the closing down of this chapter of his life, ready to begin the next. He'd intended to hit the road by 6 p.m, and it was already nearly 3. He sighed and he let his shoulders slump, and he said,
Sure thing, of course. I'll be there in, like, a couple of hours.
No, come now. Please come now.
He sighed again.
No problem, he said. I'll be there in 10.
And what was it? Sophie asks now. What did Scarlet want?
Some kind of breakdown, I think, Liam replies. She was shaking, fetal. Her mother sort of made out she was attention-seeking.
He shrugs. Maybe she was. I don't know. But I knew I couldn't leave her. I knew she still needed me. Told my dad I wasn't coming home yet, and moved in with her for a while. Then a vacancy for a classroom assistant turned up here at the school, and I thought I could just do it for a few weeks, just to stay close to Scarlet.
He says, and yeah, here I still am, over a year later.
Why? Asks Sophie. Why didn't you go home when Scarlet left? He grimaces. I didn't know she wasn't coming back. I thought they'd just gone away for the summer. And then it was September again, and they didn't come back. And then I thought they'd be back for Christmas, and they weren't. Then it was 2018, and Scarlet stopped replying to my messages and my phone calls completely, and I thought, well, she's moved on. It's over. But I liked it here, so I stayed.
And the pool party?
She asks gently, not wanting to push too hard.
What happened that night?
He lifts his eyes to hers and sighs.
Christ, who knows? All I know is that I have no idea why those kids were even there. The guy, Zach, I'd say he was kind of dark. I kept picking up on a weird vibe between him and the girl. At the pub it felt like the girl really didn't want to come back to the house. He really had to persuade her. And then once they were there, at Scarlet's, they just felt kind of out of place. They didn't really want to join in. You could tell the guy was brooding about something or other. Jealous, probably.
Jealous? Of what? Liam blinks and she sees him hold his breath.
Oh God, I don't know. The size of the house, the privilege, all of that kind of thing, I suppose. Anyway, the atmosphere was awkward. And then my friend Lexi. She lives here too. She's Carrie Ann's daughter.
Sophie nods.
She was driving back to the school, and I'd had enough by then, and we offered the couple a lift back to the village. And she was like, yes, that'd be great. But he said, no, we're staying. I saw him sort of tug her back into her chair, and I felt really sorry for her. And I told all of this to the police at the time, obviously. And I think the girl's mother, Kim, I think she thought there was something a bit off about him. That it might have had something to do with him. That he offed her. Then disappeared somehow. But you know, how could there be no evidence? That's what always confused me. They were there, and then they weren't. Not a drop of blood, not a sniff of death. Two whole people. Just gone. Doesn't make any sense, does it? He drops his eyes to Sophie's phone and looks again at the photo of the ring. And now, he says, making the image larger with his fingers, it's starting all over again. Chapter 24, February 2017. Tallulah stares down the long driveway through the elaborate metal gate towards Scarlett's house, where it emerges from a crown of trees at the top of a small hillock. It looks like it could still be another mile away. She squeezes her bike through the narrow pedestrian gap to the side of the gates and then remounts and cycles onwards. She doesn't know what she's doing or why she's doing it. She just feels like the walls of her life are closing in on her, and she needs to find a gap just for a minute, just so she can breathe. As she draws closer to the house, she gasps quietly to herself. It's magical. The sort of house that you have a really intense dream about, and then wake up the next morning feeling sad that it's not real. She leans her bike against a wall and crunches across white gravel towards the front door. For a moment, she considers calling Scarlett, giving her a chance to pretend to be out or to hide. But then she looks at the time and sees it's only an hour until Zach gets back from football, and she's made it all the way, and she just really, really wants to see her. She presses the doorbell and clears her throat and touches her hair and clears her throat again, and a moment later, she hears a female voice calling. Coming! And it's her. It's Scarlett. And she's getting closer to the door, and she's opening the door. And Tallulah realizes she has been holding her breath, and as the door opens and Scarlett's gaze takes her in, there is a tiny fraction of a moment where someone should say something, but nobody does. And Tallulah almost says, I should go. But before the words leave her mouth, Scarlett gives her head a small shake, blinks, and says, Oh my God, it's Tallulah from the bus. A large dog ambles into view. It's the dog from Scarlett's self-portrait in the art block at college. It's gigantic. Hi, says Tallulah. I'm sorry to just turn up, but I was just chatting with Mimi and she said if I saw you in the village, I was to say hello and tell you to get in touch. And then I did see you in the village, but you drove off before I could say anything. And the girl in the shop, I kind of know her and she told me where you lived. And I just kind of thought I could come and pass on the message in person, kind of. You emailed me, didn't you? Yeah, after I saw you in the village. And I didn't reply. No, but that's fine, totally fine. I wasn't expecting you to. How did you get here? Tallulah turns her head towards the bike. I cycled. The dog has walked past Scarlett and is now standing right next to Tallulah, panting loudly. Can I? She asks. Can I stroke him? Of course you can. My God, yes, he lives for being stroked by strangers. He's a total whore. Tallulah presses her hand into the dog's thick fur and smiles. I remember, says Scarlett. You like dogs. You said you wanted one. Did you get one? Tallulah shakes her head and crouches down to be face to face with the dog. What's his name? She says, scruffing under his huge jowls. Toby. Yeah, he looks like a Toby. For a moment, it feels like there's nothing left to be said. Tallulah straightens up and says, Anyway, that was all really. Just Mimi says to stop being a fucking dick and to let everyone know how you are because they're worried about you.
She glances at Scarlett, assessing her response to the message. She sees that Scarlett looks thinner than ever, that her hair has grown out into surprisingly dark roots, that she's dressed less theatrically than she used to dress for college, in plain cut jeans and an old sweatshirt with the words Guernsey Yacht Club and a little red and white flag printed on it.
"Want to come in?"
she says.
Yeah, sure, if that's okay with you.
It's okay with me.
I can't stay long. I need to be home by 2, so...
Let's have a cup of tea, says Scarlett. Everyone's out, so it's nice and quiet. Tallulah follows Scarlett through the hallway and into an extraordinary kitchen, which looks like a glass box stuck onto the back of the house. Even on this overcast day, it is dazzlingly bright, a dozen halogen lights sparkling off the glossy work surfaces and cabinets. A delicate wooden table surrounded by grey velvet dining chairs sits by a set of huge sliding doors that open out onto a sun terrace and just beyond what looks like a swimming pool with the cover drawn over it. Overhead is a perspex chandelier dripping with red beads. The walls are white painted brickwork hung with abstract canvases. At the other end of the glass box is a seating area with an electric blue L-shaped sofa and the biggest plasma screen Tallulah has ever seen. The dog follows closely behind Tallulah and then collapses at her feet when she sits down. He loves visitors more than he loves his own family. It's pathetic, really, says Scarlett, filling up the kettle and switching it on. Tallulah smiles and says, "He's lovely. You're really lucky." There's a beat of silence.
"So,"
she says,
"have you got a message for me to send back to Mimi and that lot?"
Scarlett, who has her back towards her, sighs.
"Oh, I don't want anything to do with Mimi, or Rue, or any of them. So, no. Just don't tell them you've seen me."
"Oh," says Tallulah. "Did you fall out?"
"Well, no, I just..."
She pulls open the fridge door and takes out a bottle and says, "Milk." Tallulah nods.
"It's complicated," Scarlett continues. "I'd rather not talk about it."
She finishes making their tea and brings the mugs over to the table.
"So, how are things at college?"
she asks. Tallulah shrugs.
"Boring. What is it you're studying again?"
"Social science and social work."
"Do you want to go into social work then?"
"Yeah." She nods and picks up her tea. "That's the plan."
"Well, that's very worthy. You're clearly a very nice person."
Tallulah laughs nervously.
"What about you? What do you want to be?"
"Dead, mainly." Scarlett replies darkly.
"Yeah, dead would be good."
Then she rallies quickly and says,
"Do you want to see something amazing?"
Yeah, sure. Tallulah replies uncertainly. She puts down her tea and gets to her feet. The dog lumbers up onto his feet too.
"Now," says Scarlett. "Seriously, you cannot tell a soul about this, okay? I mean, this is literally mind-blowing, and I am literally the only person in the world that knows about it, and in a minute, you will be literally the second person in the world to know about it. Can I trust you?"
Tallulah nods.
"Yes,"
she says.
"Of course."
Scarlett's eyes stay on her for a moment, assessing her. Then she smiles and says,
"Come on, this way."
They wend their way through the house, through snugs and piano rooms and boot rooms and hallways and studies and dining rooms and sitting rooms and drawing rooms, until they reach a small door set into the corner of what Scarlett refers to as the Tudor wing. The room is small and contains just a black lacquered desk, a brass standard lamp with a red velvet shade, and a piece of modern art hanging from an ancient timbered wall. The door is wooden and has a latch opening.
"So?"
says Scarlett, opening up the door and peering upwards. "This is the staircase to the turret room." She moves out of the way so that Tallulah can see. It's a set of spiral stone stairs, very small,
very narrow. They look like the sort of stairs tourists queue to go up in cathedrals and such.
Oh,
she says.
Wow.
Well, yeah, but that's not the amazing thing. The amazing thing is this. Scarlett falls to her knees and pulls a strange tool from the back pocket of her jeans. It's ancient looking, slightly rusted, has a long handle with a kind of flat foot on the bottom, which she inserts into the underside of the first step and then uses to lever away the stone from its setting. She carefully removes the piece of stone and sets it behind her. A cold draft blows through the hole and Tallulah shivers slightly. I found this book, Scarlett is saying as she slides her hand into the open hole in the staircase. A history of this house, and there was something in there about a secret tunnel, like an escape tunnel. This wing was built during the English Civil War in 1643, and the architect was asked to include a secret tunnel in case the inhabitants needed to hide or run away, and... Her face contorts as she tries to get hold of something inside the hole. The plans were destroyed in a fire that burned down half of the building. In fact, that's why it became called Dark Place, because of the dark circle that surrounded it after the fire, all the charred wood. So the house was abandoned and empty for nearly 70 years until a really cool young couple from London bought it, probably equivalent to hipsters of today, wanted a doer-upper, something with a bit of character. And they were the ones who attached the Georgian wing. It was seen as super, super modern at the time. No one could quite believe their eyes. It was the talk of the village. Anyway, this couple had no idea where the tunnel was and spent years trying to find it and moved back to London when they were old without ever finding it. And by the 1800s, everyone just thought it was a myth, that it had never existed. And then, early in 2017, a young woman called Scarlett Jacques, who had nothing to do all day because she'd left college under a cloud and was depressed and incredibly bored, decided to make it her mission to find the tunnel. And finally, after many, many days, she had a brainwave. What if? She pants slightly as she pulls hard at something in the hole, suddenly lifting the entire stone panel, removing it and putting it next to the first piece of stone. What if, she continues, the architect decided that the best place for an underground staircase was at the base of an overground staircase? And what if that weird metal thing that's been hanging off a hook in the wood store since the day we moved in, what if that might be the key to open the base? She leans back and brushes some hair from her face. And lo and behold, she says to Tallulah, waving her arm across the opening. She was fucking right. Tallulah's mouth is hanging open. She stares into the hole and then up at Scarlett. Oh my God, she whispers. The dog has been snuffling at the pieces of stone and now passes Tallulah to peer down the hole, sniffing the air loudly. Want to come and have a look inside? Says Scarlett, turning on the flashlight on her phone. I'm not sure. I really need to get back, and I'm arachnophobic. Like, seriously, full-blown panic attacks. Just come and see the room at the bottom of the steps. There's no spiders there, I promise. It's really cool. Come. An image passes through her subconscious, an image of her in a spider-filled tunnel, looking up at Scarlett, who cackles maniacally, whilst pulling the stone cover back into place. Tallulah told no one she was coming here. There's nobody else in the house. All that's here is her mother's bike, which Scarlett could easily dispose of. She could seal Tallulah up down there, and no one would ever hear her, and no one would ever know. She thinks of Scarlett's self-portrait in the art block at Manton, the cake knife with the blood on it, the handgun, the fresh beating heart on the plate. And she wonders about this girl, whom she barely knows. Who is Scarlett Jacques? What is she? But then she looks at Scarlett and sees the cool girl from college, the girl that everyone wants to be. And she's looking back at Tallulah with a playful smile, saying,
Come on, I'm not going to eat you.
And she follows her into the hole, her hands grasping onto damp brick walls as the steps lead downwards. Chapter 25, July 2017. June turns to July. Noah turns from 12 to 13 months. Kim gives up her part-time job at the estate agency up the road. Ryan cancels his first parentless holiday to Rhodes. On the calendar on the kitchen wall, Kim sees her handwriting in the square for the 17th of July. Last day term, Tallulah. She weeps. The police had finally got permission to search the Jacques' house, but they found nothing untoward, and it turned out that the Jacques' security system hadn't been armed that night, that all the cameras were off.
My fault entirely, Joss Jacques said. I never follow instructions properly. Drives Martin insane.
Shortly afterwards, Scarlett and her family flew out to their house in the Channel Islands and never came back. Towards the end of July, Kim cancels her August holiday to Portugal, to the cute little family-friendly resort with the creche that she and Tallulah had pored over pictures of, imagining Noah there, making new friends, maybe toddling by then, splashing in the baby pool with inflatable armbands, a zip-up swimming costume and a sun hat. The lady on the phone is incredibly understanding when Kim explains her circumstances and grants her a full refund. Kim cries for half an hour afterwards. Kim's ex-husband Jim comes and goes. He stays for a few nights, as long as he can get off work, as long as his mother will let him leave her, and then he goes back to Glasgow again. In a way, Kim would prefer it if he didn't come at all. He brings nothing to the situation. No reassurance, no practical assistance, just extra food to buy and cups of tea to make and bedsheets to wash. In early August, he comes again, and the moment he walks into the house, Kim knows that something's up with him. He looks washed out and tense.
I just saw that woman,
he says, dropping his jacket and his bag onto the floor in the hallway.
The mother.
Meg's?
Yeah, whatever her name is. Do you know what she said to me?
Kim lowers her eyes. She has tried her hardest to avoid Meg's and Simon ever since the day of the police search. She crosses streets when she sees them, turns and walks out of shops.
Oh, God, she says. No, tell me. She said that she thinks Tallulah and Zach have eloped, gone off for a nice extended honeymoon. She said it was all too much for them, having that baby so young. I can't say I'm surprised.
Kim sighs and shakes her head. And what did you say?
I said she was mad. I said she needed her head tested.
Was Simon there?
Yeah.
What did he say?
Not a lot.
Did you remind her that neither of them has used their bank accounts since the night they went missing?
Yep, she said they were probably using cash.
Right, says Kim, rolling her eyes.
Course they are. They're probably rolling around in banknotes in the bridal suite at the Ritz fucking Carlton right now. I'm so angry,
says Jim.
So angry that they can take it so lightly. When their son might have, you know.
And then he starts to cry. And finally, for the first time since Tallulah disappeared, Kim feels like she and Jim are in the same place. A place of shared horror and fury and rage. And she opens her arms and he comes into them and they hold on to each other for a long time. And it's the first time they've touched like that in over 10 years. And for a moment, Kim is glad he's there. Glad to have someone to share this with. To stand in this corner of hell with her and hold on to her. But then she feels his cheek pass across her cheek and his groin a little too close to her thigh, and his lips are suddenly on hers, and she gasps and pushes him away, hard. So hard, he almost loses his footing. He stares at her for a moment, and she stares at him, her breath coming hard. And then she watches as he picks up his jacket and his bag, opens the front door, and then closes it quietly behind him. Soon it is September,
and Kim sees the square on the calendar in her kitchen in which she has written the words, "Tallulah back to college." She feels too numb to weep. Noah turns 15 months and can walk and talk. Ryan gets a girlfriend called Rosie, with whom he spends all his time in his room. Kim runs out of money and has to take out a bank loan. D.I. McCoy calls occasionally with updates which seem more like they should be called down dates. Each time he speaks to her, it becomes clearer and clearer that they have nothing to go on. The tire prints on the driveway outside Dark Place belong to Lexi Mulligan's car. CCTV footage of the main roads in and out of Upfield Common and environs show nothing. Zach's employers say he was a good lad. Tallulah's college says she was a great girl. A sea of blank faces, shaken heads. Nobody has an explanation for what might have befallen them. Kim is haunted constantly by the image of Zach gripping Tallulah's arms in the snug at Scarlett's house that midsummer's night and the sparkly ring in the pocket of his jacket. She goes to Tallulah's room sometimes to search again and again for the thing that will open up the mystery to her, dislodge the logjam. But she finds nothing, and months pass. Soon it is June again, and Noah turns 2 and has his first haircut. On the anniversary of Tallulah's disappearance, Kim leads a candlelight procession through the village in an attempt to get some more publicity for her missing girl, in an attempt to get people to care again. Megs and Simon leave the village to live closer to 2 of their adult daughters who have both recently had babies. They don't say goodbye. Kim gets a place for Noah at the nursery school in the church hall at St. Bride's for 4 days a week, and she gets a job at the Swan and Ducks doing the lunchtime shifts. She pays off her bank loan. Ryan and Rosie split up, and Ryan gets a new girlfriend called Mabel, who has a flat in Manton, and he moves in with her. And this is now Kim's life. Dropping Noah at nursery, shifts at the pub, collecting Noah from nursery, shopping, cooking, eating. She doesn't go out now on Friday nights because she has no one to sit with Noah. She drinks wine alone and watches programmes about plastic surgery gone wrong and dogs having hip replacement operations. And still, nothing changes. Nothing happens. Until one morning in early September, 15 months after Tallulah disappeared, a woman appears at her door. A strikingly attractive woman, with soft blonde hair and a pretty summer dress. And this woman, her name is Sophie, has found a ring in the grounds of Maypole House, and it's Zach's ring, and it had, apparently, an arrow next to it suggesting that someone dig for it, that someone find it. And there it is. At long last, a sign that someone out there knows something. A sign that Tallulah's story is not yet over. When the woman leaves, Kim picks up her phone and she scrolls through her contacts to one she has not used for months and months. "Hello, Dom, it's Kim." She stopped calling him D.I. McCoy some time ago, and he stopped calling her Ms. Knox. "There's been a development." Chapter 26, September 2018.
Soph, there's a Detective Inspector McCoy here to see you. In reception.
It's Sean on the phone, sounding rather confused and distracted. "Oh," she replies. "Yes, that's probably right." There's a beat of silence during which Sophie realises she's meant to say something. "I dug that thing up," she says. "In the woods. Turns out it's connected to a missing person case."
"The thing?"
"You know, that sign I told you about on our garden fence that said, 'Dig here.' I dug. It was an engagement ring."
"Oh," says Sean. "Right. You didn't tell me."
"Well, no, I only found out who it belonged to yesterday and you were at work and..."
"Well, anyway," he cuts in. "What should I..."
"Shall I come over?" she asks. Slightly breathlessly.
"I suppose, yes. I'll get someone to find a room for you."
And then he hangs up, rather abruptly,
and Sophie thinks it's the first time he's ever spoken to her impatiently. D.I. McCoy is disarmingly attractive. A deep summer tan, sun-burnished brown hair, a crisp baby blue shirt under a dark blue suit. He's sitting in a small meeting room just behind the reception office. There's a pane of glass in the door through which Sophie is aware of a head bobbing just out of sight. The presence of a police officer in the school is causing frissons of warped energy. The fact that he is here to talk to the new headteacher's girlfriend is adding even more controversy to the situation. D.I. McCoy gets to his feet as she enters and shakes her hand.
Thank you, he says. I'm sorry to interrupt you in the middle of the school day.
Oh, no, honestly, it's fine. I don't work here, so it's, you know.
Well, he sits down again. I assume you know what I'm here to talk to you about.
The ring?
D.I. McCoy checks his notes. Yes, the ring. Found in the school grounds. By you.
Correct.
And this was when, exactly?
A few days ago. I put it away at first in a drawer because I didn't know what to make of it. Then it kept playing on my mind, so I got it out of the drawer and cleaned the box and found the name of the jewellery shop. I took it there yesterday and then took it straight round to the owner, but he doesn't live there anymore. Apparently, well, the woman who lives there, Kim, she told me that he's a missing person.
That's right. He disappeared on the 16th of June, 2017, with his girlfriend. And there was a theory that he might have taken his girlfriend out that night to propose to her. So the ring suddenly reappearing after all this time is quite a big development. Essentially, it reopens the case.
Sophie nods, somewhat fervently, trying not to betray her excitement. I suppose it does, she says.
So Ms. Knox tells me that you found this ring after following the directions written on a note?
Kind of. There was a sign nailed to our garden fence with an arrow. I can show you if you like. It's still there. I didn't touch it.
Yes. Yes, please.
The detective puts his pen and notepad back into his jacket pocket and gets to his feet. She leads him through the grounds of the college and through the cottage. I saw it on the first day we were here, she says, opening up the back door. I just assumed it was left over from a treasure hunt or something. She unclips the back gate and gestures at the fence with her left hand. I didn't really think anything of it at all at first. D.I. McCoy looks down at the fence and then looks up at Sophie questioningly. Sophie looks down. The sign is gone. Chapter 27, February 2017. Tallulah gets home 30 seconds after Zach. He's sitting on the bottom step, unlacing his trainers, a towel draped around his neck, his hair shiny with sweat. He looks at her strangely.
Hi,
says Tallulah casually.
Where have you been?
Just for a cycle,
she replies. He narrows his eyes at her.
On a bike?
She laughs dryly.
Yes, of course, on a bike. What else?
You haven't got a bike.
Borrowed Mum's.
But what about Noah?
What about Noah?
You left him?
Yeah, I left him with Mum. She told me to go out and get some exercise. I had a headache.
He pulls off his second trainer and lays it next to the first.
Where'd you go?
Just around,
she says, unzipping her coat and taking it off. She hangs it up, then calls out for her mum.
In here!
She follows her mum's voice into the living room, where she's sitting on the sofa with Noah on her lap. She takes Noah from her mum and spins him round, then kisses him noisily on his cheek and hugs him to her.
How's my gorgeous boy?
She says,
how's my gorgeous, gorgeous boy?
The feel of him in her arms after her time at Scarlett's house is indescribably relieving. Her skin still crawls with the damp memory of the walls of the tunnel underneath Scarlett's house, and she's been rubbing imaginary cobwebs off her face, out of her hair, ever since she climbed out of the hole and back into the daylight.
"Isn't it the coolest thing ever?"
Scarlett had said, her eyes shining in the light from her phone. Tallulah had smiled nervously and rubbed at the bare skin on her forearms and said,
"It's so spooky." "Yes, but just think,"
Scarlett had continued. "We might be the first people to have been down there for like 300, 400 years. The last people who set foot down here would have been wearing like wimples, talking Shakespearean."
"Have you walked to the other end?"
"Fuck no."
Scarlett shook her head hard.
"God knows what's down there. A fucking Demogorgon."
She shuddered and pulled the sleeves of her sweatshirt down over her hands. Tallulah shuddered too and put her hands into the soft coat of Toby, who stood panting lightly beside her. Then Scarlett put her hand into Toby's fur, and her fingers found Tallulah's and laced themselves around them, and Tallulah's breath caught at the sensation. She glanced up and saw Scarlett staring at her, a soft smile playing at the corners of her mouth. Tallulah had left a few moments later and cycled hard all the way home, trying to purge the darkness of the tunnel, the feel of Scarlett's fingers entwined around hers, and the slightly nauseating jolt of energy she'd felt pass between them that suggested something so far beyond herself or the person she perceived herself to be that it almost felt like a wound. Now she sits Noah on her knee and rests her lips against the crown of his head, relishing the smell of his scalp, the feeling of being home. Her mum says, "Did you have a nice ride?"
"Yeah,"
she says.
"It was good to get out."
Zach walks in.
"How was the football?"
Tallulah asks, wanting to move away from the topic of her bicycle ride.
"Great,"
he says, sitting down heavily next to her and placing his hand around the back of her neck. "We thrashed them 4-0. He smells of the pitch, of men, of fresh sweat. She's suddenly repulsed by his proximity, the feel of his hand against her skin, his very precise male odours.
"Aren't you going to shower?"
"Do I smell?"
He lifts his arm and sniffs his own armpits. She forces a smile and says,
"Of course you don't. You're covered in other people's sweat, though."
He returns her smile and gives the back of her neck a small squeeze before getting to his feet.
"Message received and understood," he says.
As he leaves the room and they listen to the sound of his bare feet heading up the stairs, Tallulah's mum turns to Tallulah and says,
"He's a good boy. He really is. I'm so glad you've let him back into your life."
Tallulah smiles tightly. She thinks, "You didn't see the look he gave me just now on the stairs. You don't know how he looks at me when you're not in the room. The way his voice sets hard like stone. His eyes bore through me like lasers. You really don't know." Scarlett is waiting at the bus stop on Monday morning.
"Morning tea from the bee,"
she says, sliding along the bench a little to make room for her.
"Happy Monday. You look tired."
"What are you doing here?"
Tallulah replies.
"Are you going back to college?"
"Hell no," says Scarlett. "I'm here to see you."
Tallulah's eyes widen.
"Why?"
Scarlett loops her arm through Tallulah's and rests her head against her shoulder.
"Because I missed you."
Tallulah laughs dryly.
"Right,"
she says, casting her eyes across the street towards her house, imagining eyes upon her and this blue-haired girl with her head on her shoulder. Scarlett lifts her head and pulls her arm back, stuffing her hand into the pocket of her furry coat. She narrows her eyes at Tallulah and says,
"Do you like me?"
Tallulah laughs again.
"Of course I like you. But do you, you know, like me?" "I don't know what you mean."
Scarlett sighs and blows out her cheeks.
"Never mind,"
she says.
I'm just so fucking bored. So fucking bored.
Why don't you come back to college?
Never,
she replies. But why? I've seen your work. You're so talented. What happened? Why did you leave?
Scarlett sighs, drops her head, and then raises it again.
You know, just stuff.
They both turn at the sound of the bus approaching from the other side of the village.
I'll come with you,
Scarlett says, getting to her feet.
Keep you company.
Tallulah glances across the common again, towards her house. She feels, very strongly, that she's being watched. On the bus, they take the back seat. Scarlett squeezes close to Tallulah, who has the window seat. She keeps up a running, slightly hyperactive commentary about the scenery, about a smell on the bus, toenail cheese, about how much she likes Tallulah's trainers. They were $19.99 from New Look. About how bored she is, how she misses her brother, hates her mother, wishes she had bigger breasts, wishes she had bigger teeth, a bigger nose, wishes she lived in London, hates her voice, misses making art, wants a puppy, wants a Sunday roast with all the trimmings. And Tallulah nods and smiles and thinks, why are you telling me all this? Why are you sitting so close? Finally, as they cross the roundabout and draw closer to town, Scarlett stops talking and turns to look from the window on the other side of the bus. Tallulah waits a few beats before saying anything. Scarlett's like a cat, the sort that lets you tickle their stomach for quite some time before suddenly scratching you and running away. She gently touches her arm and she says,
are you okay?
Scarlett shrugs, and Tallulah notices a film of tears come to her eyes.
Oh, you know,
she says, her voice cracking slightly.
Just your typical level 2, fucked up rich girl having a stupid crisis. Just ignore me. It's best.
What happened with your boyfriend? Tallulah asks, wondering if maybe Scarlett has a broken heart.
The one who's at the Maypole.
Scarlett shakes her head.
We're finished,
she said.
Just before Christmas.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
No, really, it's fine. I ended it. It had been going on for too long. I wasn't in love with him, but, you know, in so many ways he made me happy. He kept me safe, and now it's just me, and it's all a bit of a car crash, really. I'm a bit ADHD, so I kind of need someone calm around me, someone to remind me how to behave. Liam was really good like that.
She sighs.
I miss him.
Can't you get back together? Scarlett shakes her head.
No, I did the right thing. I cut him free.
She pauses.
What about you?
Tallulah looks at her questioningly.
Do you have a boyfriend?
Oh, she says. Yeah, kind of. We split up a year ago, but we got back together just after New Year.
What made you decide to get back together with him?
Tallulah starts to speak and then stops. Words to describe her son, her motherhood, her real life, sit on the tip of her tongue, waiting to be spilled. But she cannot bring herself to do it. Once those words are out of her mouth, she will be Tallulah the teenage mum, not Tallulah from the bus.
I don't know, she replies after a moment. I'm starting to think maybe it was a mistake.
Scarlett raises an eyebrow.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, I know. He's changed since we were last together. He's more...
She scrolls through a dozen adjectives in her mind before finding the right one.
Controlling.
Scarlett draws her breath audibly and shakes her head.
Oh, she says. Oh, no. No, 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 controlling man. They're the worst. You need to get out of that. You need to get out of that fast.
Tallulah turns to the window, not saying what she should be saying, that it's not that simple, that he lives with her, that they have a baby together.
Yes,
she murmurs.
You're right.
Who was that girl at the bus stop this morning?
Zack is lying on their double bed in his work clothes. He's still supposed to be at work and makes her jump.
God, Zack!
She puts her hand to her heart.
What are you doing here?
Had a headache,
he says. Asked to leave early. She squints at him.
Couldn't you just have taken some pills?
Didn't have any on me.
He sits up and wraps his arms around his knees.
Was it the girl?
He says.
The one in the photo on your phone from the Christmas party?
Yes, she lives near here.
Thought you said she'd left college.
She blinks. How did he remember her telling him that?
Yes,
she says.
She left. She was just going into town.
He nods. She seemed quite touchy-feely. She shrugs.
Seems strange,
he continues. A girl you barely know, yet you have selfies with her on your phone, and then she's cuddling up to you at the bus stop, like she's your best friend.
She's just that sort of person,
Tallulah says, unzipping her rucksack and taking out her assignment folder. Noah's napping in her mum's room, and she'd planned to use the quiet hour to get some homework done.
A bit intense, you know.
Where does she live then, this intense girl?
No idea,
she replies. The last syllable catches on a gulp.
Somewhere around here, that's all I know.
He nods, then slowly pulls himself off the bed. He takes a couple of steps towards her, and then draws himself up tall. He looks down into her eyes and hooks a finger under her chin, tipping her face up towards him. His eyes trace circles across all of her.
You're different,
he says. She pushes his finger away from her chin and turns away.
No, I'm not.
He pulls her back hard by the arm.
Don't walk away from me, I'm trying to talk to you.
Her head rocks back slightly at the force of his words.
I've got college work to do. I haven't got time for this.
This?
He says.
You mean us? You haven't got time for us?
No,
she says, feeling her heart pump hard.
I haven't got time for us. I've got time for Noah. I've got time for college. And that's it. I don't have time for us. You're right.
There is an immediate and profound silence. Zack shifts from one foot to the other.
What are you trying to say, Lula?
I'm not trying to say anything. You said I don't have time for us, and I'm agreeing with you. I don't have time. There's never time.
But if you really wanted this to work, you'd find the time. So what's the deal? Do you want this to work or not? Because I've got a job, Lula. I actually work to bring money into this family every day, and I'm hands-on with Noah 24/7. But yeah, funny thing, I've still got time for you, for us. So why haven't you?
I don't know, she replies. I don't know.
There's a beat of silence, and then Zack sighs and pulls her towards him. Pulls her so hard that she feels her ribcage bend under the pressure, her lungs contract, her breath stop halfway up her throat. Chapter 28, September 2018. The police have cordoned off the woods again. The sight of the plastic ribbon fluttering in the late summer breeze sends Kim back in time to the hazy, frazzled heat of that June afternoon last year. The weight of Noah in her arms, the sweat running down her back, the blinding white glamour of the Jacques' house in Upley Fold, the cobalt blue of the swimming pool, the empty eyes of Megs and Simon, the stale smell of lunchtime rosé on their breath, the eager rustle of the sniffer dogs as they headed into the darkness of the woods. She shivers at the sight of it, but then straightens up and smiles when she sees D.I. Dom McCoy climbing out of his unmarked car.
Hi,
she says.
Nice to see you, Kim,
he replies.
Here we go again.
She rolls her eyes and says,
Indeed we do.
He leads her to a spot away from the cars in the shade of a large tree.
The sign has gone. I went to view it with Miss Beck this morning, and it's been taken down. The nail is still embedded in the fence, but the sign has gone. However, thankfully, Miss Beck did think to take a photograph of the sign, so we have that to send out for analysis. She writes detective novels, apparently, So I guess her mind works like that.
Kim raises an eyebrow. Does she really?
Yes, I know. She doesn't look the type. Not exactly Agatha Christie, is she?
Kim smiles.
No, not exactly. Anyway, we've sent the photo for handwriting analysis, etc. But it definitely looks to me like someone is actively trying to draw us back to the case. Someone who knew that a new head teacher was arriving. Someone who wanted the engagement ring to be uncovered. Someone, it feels like, who wants to play games with us. But why would someone want to do that?
Dom sighs.
People want to do all manner of things, Kim. If it wasn't for people doing things that the likes of you and I would never do, I'd be out of a job. My theory, currently, is that this is someone who has known something all along, whilst remaining in the shadows. Someone who knows what happened to Tallulah and Zack. And for whatever reason, they've grown bored of the silence, grown bored of nobody being caught.
Kim flinches at his use of the word caught. Caught suggests that someone has done something to her child. It suggests that her child is dead. And not once, not in all the nearly 15 months that have passed since she watched her daughter leave the house in cut-off denim shorts and a smock top, an uncertain smile on her face as she kissed her baby son goodbye and headed out into the soft warmth of a sunny summer night. Not once has Kim imagined that possibility to be anything other than a sliver of a bad dream that she could easily chase away with the power of her own thoughts.
Annoyingly, the school CCTV doesn't extend this far. It cuts off just on the boundary of the residential area. Miss Beck and Mr. Gray have CCTV on the front of their cottage, but not at the back. We're going through footage now, but unless we have a picture of someone flagrantly walking across the campus holding a cardboard sign, a nail and a hammer, it'll be a little bit of a needle in a haystack. But,
he shrugs and smiles hopefully,
you never know.
Kim closes her eyes briefly and musters a smile.
Are you okay?
No,
she says.
I feel sick.
I'm not surprised,
says Dom. He reaches out and touches her arm.
But maybe this is it, Kim,
he says.
Maybe this is the turning point. A little flame of hope.
Yes, she says. Maybe it is.
She calls Ryan when she gets home and fills him in on the police activity in the woods. It's lunchtime, but she's not hungry. She puts her hand into a bag of Noah's favourite cereal and eats the nuggets from the palm of her hand, like a pony eating sugar cubes. She checks the time. 3 hours until she collects Noah from nursery. Dom told her that he'd have an update for her in the early evening. Her next shift at the Swan and Ducks is not until tomorrow. She'd been pleased when she'd seen the gap between shifts on her rota the previous week. She'd been looking forward to the time off. But now she wishes she was at work. Her mind taken off the painful events unfolding behind Maypole House. She opens up her laptop and types, not for the first time, the name Scarlett Jax into the search box. And once again, the internet shows her nothing. A defunct Instagram account. A defunct Facebook page. A defunct Twitter account. She types in the name, Joss Jax, and gets nothing at all. She cannot for the life of her remember the name of Scarlett's brother, the handsome boy who'd opened the front door to her all those months ago, with a beer in his hand. As she's done at intervals over the past year, she tries calling Mimi on a number that remained on her phone after their conversation when Tallulah and Zack had disappeared. And as happens every time, it hits a dead tone. She sighs and runs her hands through her hair. The key players, all the people who were there that night, the people who might know what happened, have vanished. The only ones who remain are the nice boy Liam, Scarlett's ex, and Lexi Mulligan, who comes and goes from the village for long intervals. It can't be a coincidence, she thinks now. It can't be a coincidence that they're all gone.
and that they've abandoned houses, social media platforms, college places, friends. And now this, the deliberate presentation of the previously missing ring to the world. Someone purposefully restarting the engines of the investigation. But why? Why now? And who? And as she thinks this, she thinks of the nice boy called Liam, the big bear-like boy with the gentle West Country burr. She thinks of the fact that he is still here, he who had the most reason to leave. He's still in the village, still at Maypole House, where he works as a teaching assistant. He would have known that there was a new head teacher arriving. He would have known about the entrance to the woods at the back door of the head teacher's cottage. He was there the night that Zack and Tallulah disappeared. Maybe he found the ring. Maybe Zack dropped it and Liam found it and kept it for some reason. Or maybe... No. She shakes her head against the thought. Such a nice boy. There's no reason why he would want to harm Zack or Tallulah. None whatsoever. But maybe he knows who did. And maybe... He's tired of keeping the secret. She switches on her phone and types in a message to Dom. You should talk to Liam Bailey again. A moment later, Dom replies. Good idea. Chapter 29. September 2018. The police are busy at the entrance to the woods. From the kitchen window, Sophie can see a police officer in a high-vis gilet holding the lead of a liver and white Springer Spaniel, also wearing a high-vis gilet. She turns at the sound of the front door opening and closing and calls out, Hello? Sean walks into the kitchen, looking tired and concerned. Bloody hell, Soph, he says, taking off his lanyard and putting it on the kitchen counter. What have you started? That ring... She says, it belonged to the boy who went missing. You know, that couple I told you about who disappeared from the village last year. He bought the ring from a shop in Manton and was going to propose to his girlfriend with it that night. And then they disappeared, and so did the ring, and now... Her words spill out in a rush. She feels guilty for some strange reason. Someone wanted us to find it. She blinks at him, surprised that he has worked this out so quickly. Yes. She says. At least, that's what it looks like. He opens the fridge, pulls out a packet of ham and starts to make himself a sandwich. Do you want one? He says, waving the packet at her. No, she says. I'll probably have something a bit later, when the police have gone. God, he says. This is the last thing I need. New job, new school year, dead fucking teenagers in the woods. He sighs. Her breath catches. You think they're going to find bodies? No, I doubt it. Apparently they did a full search of the woods twice when they disappeared. But still, even if they don't find anything, the press are going to jump on it, aren't they? And I'll be overseeing a media circus. He sighs again. Do you hate me? She asks him. Of course I don't hate you. But I am wondering why you didn't tell me about the ring. Why you didn't mention to me that you'd found it. That you were going to take it to the woman, to the mother. He spreads butter onto fat white bread. She sees the muscles of his face straining under his skin, his knuckles white and pronounced. She thinks of the sun-tanned man in t-shirts and shorts she'd spent her last few London summer weeks with. The guy with the ready smile, and the look in his eye of a man who couldn't quite believe his luck. She wonders where he's gone, a week into this new life. I suppose I thought you had more important things to worry about, she says. I was bored, I guess, and I thought it would be fun to follow up a mystery. It just went a bit further than I thought it would. I'm sorry it's landed on you. I really am. Hopefully it'll all fizzle out. He says, snapping the lid onto the butter tub and putting it back in the fridge. Unlikely. They just asked to speak to a member of staff. Sophie's heart jumps slightly. Which? I mean, who?
Liam Bailey, he says. He's a special ed assistant. I think you met him at the registration day dinner. Apparently he was around the night those kids disappeared.
He closes up his sandwich and cuts it in half.
So, yeah, I suspect this might...